Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze. Everybody who was there
was either getting a contact high or was just puffing away. But they're politically correct, and they were connected to Lowell Bergman, who was formerly with CBS. Anyway, there was a TV news clip about the Sacramento County Sheriff, who was setting up roadblocks to check the driver's license and insurance of motorists. And they stopped several vehicles which had illegal aliens, people who had no driver's license, and, of course, no insurance, so they towed the vehicle. And, of course, all the radical leftists were screaming unfair, and a couple of these drivers, uninsured motorists, said they're just going to go and get another truck. So that's the attitude. You know, when they defy the law, and they, when they're caught defying the law, they just go out and do it again, and we don't deport them. This is one of the problems where we're becoming disenfranchised in our own country. Of the medical news today, which is important, and of course it ties into the Nobel Peace Prize, or the Nobel Prize, in 1787, Thomas Guadalet was born, and he's the guy that started the medical care and education for deaf people. There's the Guadalet School, I think in Washington, D.C. And of course, we have the famous case of Helen Keller, a movie with Anne Bancroft. I forgot the name of it. But that's one to look at, especially if you know deaf people, and they can function in society. They were formerly treated as borderline insane or insane and locked away in horrible conditions in these insane asylums. And then in medicine, since we're talking about medicine, we had Marie Curie, Polish woman, married a Frenchman, Pierre Curie. She's the only woman and one of two people to ever get a double prize, to twice win the Nobel Prize in two different fields. She got it in chemistry and discovery of radium, which eventually caused other ailments, which caused her death. Had a lot of tragedy. She lost her husband. They both worked together in a famous lab, and there's a movie with Walter Pidgeon and Greer Garson, 1943 film, great film, called Madame Curie, very simple, and it's very accurate in its documentation of her work. And there was a lot of prejudice in France against women who were scientists. Also, at the time she wasn't in France when she came from Poland because she didn't have any money. She was a poor student, brilliant student. She got caught up in an affair and was accused of being Jewish, and this was a time of the xenophobia, which was whipped up by the radical right-wing anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic newspapers and media morons in the Alfred Dreyfus case, the Captain Alfred Dreyfus case. And, of course, I've talked about it many times, and it still resonates, unfortunately, today when we see a lot of this anti-Semitism involving military people in America. And it's come up in the case of Steve Mary, which you can go to the website, AmicusVeritas.org, AmicusVeritas.org. It will be updated. And then to our YouTube sites, Amicus Veritas YouTube, AmicusVeritas YouTube. And today we have other people. The other person to win a double Nobel Prize was Linus Pauling, who was a Stanford, California scientist. He got one for peace and also some other work that he did. I forgot what it was. And it's interesting, of the people who got the Peace Prize, I'll go through it. It's since this is Nobel Day, apparently. We have, starting in 1920, President Wilson. And a lot of people don't know that he got the Nobel Peace Prize, I guess, for pushing the League of Nations, which we in the United States did not join. Excuse me. Then we had Einhoven, famous scientist. He got the a prize from Nobel, the Nobel Committee. And then we have, let's see, who else we have here? Jane Addams was a co-winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. We got, and Ralph Bunche was the first American black to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1950. We had Lech Walesa. I guess he couldn't go, the Polish, another Pole. His wife went to get the Nobel Peace Prize. And then we had terrorists, or depends how you look at them, were freedom fighters. Menachem Begin, who was part of the Stern Gang, which blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, later became Prime Minister of Israel. Him and Anwar Sadat, who was also considered a terrorist by the British when they occupied Egypt, and later became president and was assassinated by the extreme Islamists in Egypt. The famous scene where he was reviewing the troops, and it was a military type assassination while he was on the dais or on the reviewing stand. And then we had Shimon Peres and Anwar Sadat got the Peace Prize, and then Ali Wiesel, who was a concentration camp survivor, he got the Peace Prize. And, of course, I think Carter, he got the prize. And then of the famous musicians, let's get to the science. Those of you who's a librarian have ever heard of the Dewey Decimal System, Melvin Dewey was born today. He invented that. And then in the entertainment field, several great both classical musicians and recording artists. The guy who discovered and promoted and who also integrated the pop field was John Hammond. Worked for CBS. He was a producer and a promoter. He discovered Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Bruce Springsteen, Robert Dylan, who actually his name was Zimmerman, from I think the Mesabi Range in Minnesota up there in Lake Superior. And he did a lot of work. He tried to integrate the pop feel, because a lot of white bands and a lot of white clubs would not allow black musicians to play there. And he did a lot of work in that field, and was groundbreaking, and also made the pop division of CBS Records, which is part of CBS, very profitable. And so born in America, I think of Bruce Springsteen all the time, although he's apparently somewhat of a leftist. And then we have, in the other entertainment field, we had Yasha Heifetz, Russian Jewish emigre, one of the greatest violinists that ever lived. He was born today. And then we had in the news field, Chet Huntley, who, when David Brinkley, they created the Huntley-Brinkley show, and Chet refused to, there was a strike with the media people, and he refused to go along with it, and he stayed on the air, if I recall this correctly. And they had the Huntley Brinkley Report. David Brinkley, who I met at the American Booksellers Convention in L.A. Many years ago, and one of the finest gentlemen I ever encountered in the media field, and he had a great voice, a perfect Southern gentleman if there ever was one. And then, of course, those of you who remember Lassie, and, of course, there have been several Lassies, that collie dog, Tommy Redig, was born in 1941 on this date. And then the Irish actor who succeeded Laurence Olivier in producing and starring in Shakespearean plays was Kenneth Branagh. I guess I pronounced it correctly. He was born today. And then this is interesting for people who follow the health of the president. We had Edith Galt in 1915. President Wilson was a widower. He had three daughters, and he's a Presbyterian, a bit of a prig, and he's the guy who resegregated Washington. A lot of people don't know that Washington was an integrated city, and that's also the city where J. Edgar Hoover was born, and J. Edgar Hoover was part African ancestry, or what they call Negro in those days. And I know how he got away with it, because he went to work for Wilson for the Justice Department in the Red Squad Daughtry, the Attorney General. And I think it was Daughtry. The Attorney General in the Wilson administration started, because of the Russian Revolution, they started rounding up suspected communists. And socialists and anybody else who espoused those radical views, and they put them on ships and deported them back to their homeland, our motherland in the case of Russia. And they called, A. Mitchell Palmer, that was the Attorney General in the Wilson administration, very controversial, and that's where J. Edgar Hoover got his start. And he was a communist hunter all his life, at least he said so. And there was some accuracy in many of the things that he said. Some of the things were a bit outrageous, but, you know, that's what happens. And then today, Edward VIII, who was uncrowned, Windsor, well, he was actually, the family's German. The original name was Battenberg, and Queen Victoria back in the late 1800s or mid-1800s married Albert of a German province, and had to be a Protestant. He had to be a Protestant, and this is where a lot of the this modern English monarchy, that's their ethnic descendant. And of course, Diana Spencer had an older her lineage and pedigree was much more royal, dating back to the Duke of Spencer, or Spencer, who was one of the Duke of Marlborough, one of the great English generals in the 17th century, and her claim to the throne was stronger than that of Prince Charles, who was originally a family of Battenberg. They changed it to Mountbatten because of the anti-German feeling in World War One, and then Queen Elizabeth later on changed the family name to Windsor. So to make it more English, but and so now Prince William, the heir apparent after Charles, is marrying, quote, a commoner. That's not the first time. But Edward VIII, apparently he was never crowned, and he abdicated for this social climber, a Wallis Simpson. And she was allegedly into a bunch of kink. She used to spank him. So I don't know why he ever married that woman, but they stayed together till his death, and Queen Elizabeth hated her. It's only many years later that she reluctantly welcomed the Duchess of Windsor to England. And during World War II, because Edward VIII's pro-German sympathies, and he had met Hitler and gone to Germany, he was shipped off to be Governor General of Bermuda to keep him out of trouble during World War II. And then of the other deaths today, besides Alfred Nobel, Red Cloud, great Indian chief, Damon Runyon, who wrote the Broadway play Guys and Dolls, and then this is a song sitting on the dock of the bay by Otis Redding. At age 26, he died in a plane crash, and of course that was a very popular song in the Vietnam War era. And then Thomas Merton was a Catholic priest, a monk, and lived in this monastery, and he was an author and intellectual. He was born today. I mean, died today. And then Anne Dvorak, gorgeous, she's a blonde. She was in a lot of the 40s cinema noir movies, for instance, Scarface, which was with Paul Muni. Paul Muni is he's dead now. He is the uncle of Michael Tilson Thomas. The family was originally Russian-Jewish, Tomaszewski, and they started the Yiddish Theater of New York. And Paul Muni changed his name, or I don't think it was his name originally. I'll have to check that again. And started a lot of socially relevant films like I'm an Escapee from a Chain Gang, Scarface, which was a play on Al Capone and the mob of that era. And then he did the one, The Life of Emile Zola, who exposed the Dreyfus case, although that was more history according to Hollywood. There were the trial and tribulations of Captain Alfred Dreyfus has been the subject of more than 8 movies, both in foreign languages and at least 3 here in the United States. And then another Catholic prelate, Fulton Sheen, used to go on TV and give weekly homilies on TV. He died today. And he had a great voice. Was Archbishop of New York during the time of Cardinal Spellman, who was a top dog. And then respecting women, in 1869, the state of Wyoming, which had few women, they granted female suffrage, the right to vote, to women who lived in that state. And then in 1898, the Spanish-American War ended. Unfortunately, I have to redo the interview with one of the relatives of a naval officer who was on the bridge of the Olympia with Admiral Dewey when they sailed into Manila Bay and fought the decrepit Spanish fleet in Manila Bay. And Admiral Cerveca was the defeated admiral. And Patrick Butler, who is one of the top journalists and real journalists in Cook County, Illinois, longtime associate, went to school together. That was his great uncle, who was on, I believe it was his uncle. We did an interview on that, and we just came across some lithographs from that period, which we'll be putting up on our Amicus Veritas YouTube site, part of the historical archives, which we put together. And then, let's see, we got everybody and all the events. Excuse me. And then what's also important, oh, yeah, we have a war criminal, Ludwig Fischer. This is Hanukkah period. And he's the guy who was born into a Catholic family, a legal officer in the Nazi Party. And he was appointed governor of Warsaw. And he's the one that started the Warsaw Ghetto and did a lot of horrible things to the both Catholics and Jewish and other non-religious. There were gypsies and other untermenschen that the Nazis persecuted and terrorized and tortured and executed and worked to death. And he was responsible for concentration camps, a lot of evil things this man did. Ludwig Fischer was executed today by a Polish court after World War II. And he was hanged, which he well deserved. And that's among the interesting executions today. Now, I did, before he died, George Christopher was California's greatest modern mayor. And, of course, he ran for governor in the primary, Republican primary, against Ronald Reagan. He lost, unfortunately. He was Republican moderate. Ronald Reagan was seen as an extreme right-wing Republican, but he won. And, of course, today, in a few weeks, we will have three San Franciscans, or two, and one from Berkeley, going to Sacramento as the top dogs in the state government. And that's Jerry Brown, who was born here. His father was, he was previously governor, and went to the seminary, the Jesuit seminary, which is now a seminary, which is now the subject of controversy about the molestation of young boys down, and big controversy. And of course, that blow-up he had with Linda Ronstadt in Africa, and so tongues are wagging and they're not stopping. And we have Newsom, Gavin Newsom, who married, who's a nephew of Nancy Pelosi. And a lot of people don't know that. And he ran for governor in the primary and lost, or he dropped out. And so as a booby prize, they gave him the lieutenant governorship. And so Jerry Brown, who's in his dotage, some people think, as people are thinking, the political cognoscenti are thinking that he's just keeping the seat warm for Gavin Newsom, who is, if you saw the movie The Candidate, Robert Redford, you'll get the drift of what we're talking about. But George Christopher, there was no other man in this state, in this century, who did as much as he did in business, in politics, and in international relations. And keeping the city together when they had race riots back in the late, very late 50s and early 60s. So this was his. I asked him in the interview. We shot it. We did a TV shoot, and also kept the audio. And I asked him, "What do you want his valedictory to? What do you want to be remembered by?" And he said, "This is best advice that a man like George Christopher could give to anybody who's in." Running for public office or who gets into public office, that they should not use that office to enrich themselves. Now, there was this, I'm surprised they didn't do the research on C-SPAN. Last week they had a guy, I forgot the name of his blog, was talking about the wealth of Dianne Feinstein Blum, Jane Harman and some other people, multimillionaires. And, of course, when Dianne Feinstein was mayor, she didn't have that kind of money. So she's worth like $77 million. That was one of the figures. But the question people are asking, the political cognoscenti are asking, where did all this wealth come from for these people? Jane Harman's wealth, she's wealthier on paper than Feinstein, Blum. And her husband is in the auto parts business, and some of these parts are allegedly made in prison industries and the abuses that go on there. So, but anyway... George Christopher did this interview. It's very interesting. He was offered money from estates when they couldn't find any heirs, and he could have kept the money, and this is how he dealt with it. Let me play it. Here we go.
You've built other projects in the city, like the housing authority projects that you built. I live in the area, and it took them longer to tear it down under Agnos and Jordan than to build the new schlock. These houses made of ticky-tacky.
Well,
the housing authority, since your administration, was the last good one. The books were balanced. We didn't have the problems that we've had since then. What would you recommend can be done to clean that mess up?
Well, you have to bear in mind that in government, there are two fundamental principles. First of all, the investing community has to have confidence in the mayor. You can have billionaires galore all over the city, and if they don't have confidence in the mayor, they're not going to participate. That's why I was able to get the Blaise-Hillebeck committee to come in. Going to the redevelopment agency, you may remember that Elmer Robinson, who is a very astute fellow himself, but still he had his ideas in a different way than I did, and he was trying to find a good, sound administrator for the redevelopment agency, and then so long ago I forget their names.
There have been a lot of them.
Yeah. But there was great criticism just before I got into office by Justin Herman in the press. Well, he was lambasting the administration terribly. And Justin Herman at that time was with the federal government. So I called him. As soon as I was there, I said, Justin, I said, I'd like to talk to you. Come on over. So he did. I said, tell me what's wrong. Well, he says, you don't get the right people in there to run it. You get one fellow and he fails, and 6 months or a year later, somebody else has to come be brought in. Not my administration, prior administrations. So this became quite a joke. I said to him, you know, there's only one way to solve this matter. He says, what's that? I said, I don't want you to fall out of your chair. He says, here's what I think is going to be my suggestion to you. You quit your job with the federal government and work for the city and county of San Francisco. Oh, my gosh. He just put his hands up. And he was shocked that I could even that I had the temerity to even make the suggestion. I said, no, I don't. Don't argue with me, I said. I've made up my mind. I want you to come here. Tell me how much it's going to cost the city. That's all I'm asking. And he says, so I've talked to him for a half an hour. And I used all the salesmanship I could command at that time. So I says, don't make up your mind right now. I says, go home and talk to your wife about it. I'm going to call you tomorrow. I want you to come back. Oh, he says, I can't do it, but I'll talk to my wife about it. Well, when he said, I'll talk to my wife about it, I knew that there was some little possibilities. And the next day, he came back again. He said, how much did you save? Well, I gave him $3,000 a year more than he was making at the federal government. That's all I gave him. That wasn't big money.
You talk about, there was a little anecdote you told me a while back about Khrushchev and his wife. Could you relate it again?
Yep. We had a little problem there. Let me see what happened on the show, on that tape. We'll pick up this other one because there were several that were done at the time. I don't know what happened here. Let's see. Okay, we'll try this one.
Bringing up the revenues in the place that could alleviate the burden in the outlying area, too.
On the small homeowner.
Well, on the small homeowners, because if we didn't have the redevelopment of Japantown, for instance, which I did, and the redevelopment of the other areas, the Golden Gateway, and also the garages that I built, which sustained the business element downtown. Otherwise, we'd have lost two or three of our major store operators. For instance, let's say, just contemplate for a minute what a disaster would be. Let's say if Macy's closed tomorrow. The destruction of that area itself would be reflected in every single home in San Francisco.
Like Cleveland was in the 70s.
Well, so you have to have a combination where the mayor has the goodwill and the confidence of the business community, the investing community. If those two elements don't work together, the city can be in trouble. I recall when I wanted to build the 5th and Mission garage, for instance, and I had, even then I had dissidents, even for that. And a group came in, they said, no, we're against it. There's a few houses down there, a few this and that, and we're against it. And one fellow got up and he said, the only reason you're doing this is because you want to help the Emporium and iMagnon and the City of Paris. And I was supposed to get up and deny that, you know. They thought I'd get up and deny it vehemently and say, no, that isn't what I'm doing it for. But I got up and I said, I want to say that you're absolutely right. That's just why I'm doing it, because I want to keep the Emporium and these other department stores active and prosperous, making money and paying taxes. And if we don't do this, we're going to lose them. Well, they were shocked that I agreed with them.
Now, that's helping the above structure. One of the major problems facing this city is deferred maintenance. And then, despite the fact that, you know, as you well know, the bonds seem to, we float them and we never know where they end up. Can you comment on that?
Well, deferred maintenance, I wish Harry Ross was still alive. He could tell you. Because when I went in, it's been a habit of mayors over the years, especially around election time.
Remember there.
You folks who are in the public realm, I say this to the newspapers and to the radio broadcasters and anybody who's involved, you have to be careful about the bond issues, because if the mayor does not pay attention to the deferred maintenance, then eventually what they do is the assets fall apart, and then they ask for a bond issue. Well, Harry Ross and I had an agreement. I would put in $18 million a year excess in the budget just for the deferred maintenance that had been eliminated in prior years, but still, in the meantime, keep up what's necessary for the present. But to catch up, and in 8 years, say I put in $160 million practically for deferred maintenance. And deferred maintenance is one of the best opportunities to avoid bond issues. Another thing, too, I never did at that time, was to take money out of the water department, Hetch Hetchy, and put it in the general fund. Today, they'll take $40, $50 million of the profits of the Hetch Hetchy project to in the general fund. In the meantime, the general fund is accelerating. Well, here's what's going to happen someday. Someday, they're going to come up with a bond for a bond issue and say, Hetch Hetchy water supply needs $100 or $200 million.
We're getting there.
And we're getting there, yes. You see, this deferred maintenance is something that nobody sees. Nobody understands what it is. It's a hidden enemy. And if you don't keep up with it, you're going to be in trouble.
Well, I'm going to keep talking about it. One of my favorite subjects, as you know, the poor sailor who's in jail and is 3 years, no fresh air or sunlight. The kid, Steve Neri, the young sailor who's been accused of killing a politician, was connected to Hallinan. We brought it up before. But when you built that jail, it was a state-of-the-art jail at the time. I remember you mentioning that you had consulted with the best prison experts, the FBI.
You mean the new rule?
Yeah, 850, Brian, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But at that time, you didn't expect people to stay there 2-3 years like they're doing right now, did you?
No. That was a kind of a temporary thing before they went to the higher element.
The big Q. Okay. What is the problem with San Bruno? That's always in the federal courts.
I don't know. You know, you're asking me questions that I'm not aware of. San Bruno, someday somebody will come along and say, we need another bond issue to.
Right, yeah. Well, we've had bond issues, and it never seems to get physically rehabilitated.
Another thing, too, that will come up sometime in the next, I would say, 3 or 4 years, will be Laguna Honda Home. Mm-hmm. And this will be a disaster, because the more it deteriorates, the more you need to rehabilitate it. And Laguna Honda Home is a very vital necessity.
What would you say, of course, we didn't get to this one, our previous conversations, but the Muni. I've been to cities, as you have, all around the world, and this is one of the best laid out transportation systems, but one of the worst managed. What would you recommend that they do to get it running efficiently?
You see, the Muni today has more problems, but, and I hate to say this, but quite a bit of it is due to personnel. And the unions, and I have nothing against the unions because I worked with them. I never, in my private business, I was there 45 years, never had any trouble. I paid the top wages. I always had a very amicable relationship. But if you give somebody just a little leeway and you're a little negligent, then these problems multiply. And, for instance, this fellow Cruz that was running the Muni for several years, he's a fine man. I know him quite well. He's a gentleman. He's a fine man in every way. But if I were the mayor at the time when Willie Brown got in, I don't think I would have appointed him as general manager of the Muni. I would have searched around and found out who was available with transportation experience. And, you just can't pick somebody off the street just because you're a secretary, make a general manager out of them, and jump them for $50,000 a year up to $160,000.
Well, I think he has an engineering degree.
What?
I think he has an engineering degree from Stanford.
That's there are a lot of engineers, but they don't know how to run it.
Right.
Yeah, that's hardly, you need a streetcar operator. That's what you need.
Yeah.
Now we've got another situation where this Booz Allen is going to come in. They're engineers too, but they've been getting some millions of dollars in the past for their opinions. Well, the opinions don't seem to work.
But they keep getting the millions.
But they keep getting the millions, yes.
One of the other problems I see in a city, and it's close to Rich Disco's in my heart, is the voter fraud. I see more and more voter fraud. I see more and more of it. I have access to the entire state's database through political consultants that I know, and I've seen things. I've even talked to some people who voted fraudulently. It seems that this city is becoming more and more balkanized. You know what I mean, especially coming from Greece, from that part. What can we do to bring this city together?
Well, that's a broad question. It calls for a broad answer.
You're a politician.
Yeah. But, getting back to what I said at the outset here, there's... Now, my memory goes back to the time when Angelo Rossi was defeated, and downtown at that time wanted to get somebody to take over the mayor's office. Nobody would run. Finally, what did they do? They got hold of Roger Lapham, an eminent businessman no expert, the story to him was, look, we know you don't know, you do not know how to run the city. We know that. We know that you're not a fiscal expert from the standpoint of running San Francisco. We want you to get in there and be a caretaker until something develops. Roger Lapman went in there. He had the clock running. Day by day was one day less. And he was just a caretaker. He didn't, but he bought the muni. He was able to arrange that. If nothing else, that was sufficient. But the climate today really is not the same as it was in those days. It was not, because that's one of the things I always held against George Riley when I ran against him. He had been appointed to the Board of Supervisors by Angelo Rossi, and yet he ran against Angelo Rossi for mayor.
That's gratitude.
One day he and I were talking, and he said, you don't seem to have much confidence in me. I said, well, no, George. I said, you've been on the Board of Equalization for a long time, and that's not my style. I said, but the only thing I would resent about you is that you ran against the man who appointed you to the Board of Supervisors. And that, I says, I don't like ingrates. That's complete ingratitude. Yeah.
The vilest weed.
Yeah.
Can we get to the lighter subject, back to Mrs. Khrushchev? Do you remember the episode when they came here?
Well, that one was cut short. We've got an emergency here. I'm going to have to cut this short. And so we'll be back Monday, and it's got a medical emergency. Things still haven't been resolved. But anyway, thank you for listening. I'm going to end the show now.